Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, schools, cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. This week, we sit down with Shirley Chung, who talks about her long and delicious journey from China to Top Chef to Culver City, where she opened up Miss Chi Cafe, which is her take on Chinese food. And we also pull from the archives for one of our favorite performances from one of our favorite New Yorkers, Annie Hart. So sit back, relax, and get ready to listen to Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
We'll be right back.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are with Shirley Chung, chef owner of Miss G Cafe in Culver City and the author of Chinese Heritage Cooking for My American Kitchen. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me. Originally born and raised in Beijing.
Yep.
I saw your, it wasn't like a TED Talk, but it was sort of like a TED Talk. And I don't want to get too distracted by it, but your story of your grandfather and his like coming and going from America is like straight out of the movie.
Yes.
Can you 100%. Give a little background of your grandparents and your grandmother? Because your grandmother was a huge influence on your food as well. Just like a quick overview of,
yeah.
Of your upbringing, because you'll do it better than I do, but it blew me away.
So I was born and raised in Beijing, China. I came to America when I was 17. But Chang family is actually five generations of Chinese American in Los Angeles. Majority of my relatives are in Pasadena. But my grandfather, at the age of 17, he was born and raised in California, but his father came to America, first generation, 1900, as a doctor herbalist from China to serve the railroad workers. It's part of Gold Rush. My grandfather was born here, but then he got sent back to China to study at age of 17 to study medicine. That's where he met my grandmother, who was China's most famous reformist, educationer, scholar. He has a lot of titles. That's
no
my great-grandfather,
no
Liang Qichao, and then she's his fifth daughter. She's also a reformist in her own, so she led a student revolution in Beijing against the by-then Republic government as well as Japanese military. So she was wounded by the old government, and that's how she met my grandfather. It was during the revolution.
Just
so,
a couple of revolutionaries being outlaws.
So they became a colleague. They supported each other. They believed in something bigger. But because they were wounded, so they would travel through China, and then finally in 1941, escaped China, came to America. My grandmother finished her education USC, history major. When my grandfather finished his medical degree, and he ended up having his externship or his residency in Harvard University. And later on, he practiced in New York. He has his own clinic, pediatrician. When my grandmother worked for Chicago Library, they're slightly separated. And then my father was born in New York, but 1949 rolled around the new China, Communist China formed,
yep.
And then my grandmother, being who she is, wants to go back to support her country, so she moved the whole entire family from New York back to China in 1949, started a brand new life in China. They have 10 years of great life. She became the foreign ambassador for China Red Cross. When my grandfather became a dean of a hospital, later on he became the assistant director of WHO, World Health Organization. He was the first Chinese representative to have that position, but also because he's Chinese American, so he speaks fluent Chinese, but fluent American English as
Amazing.
Well. But then 10-year Cultural Revolution in China happened, so my grandfather got thrown in jail, and my grandmother, during that 10-year, tried to break him out. They were accused him of...
Sorry, literally break him out?
Well, within connections.
Sure.
To try to bring him out because he still have U.S. passport, so Chinese government back then accused him of being a spy. He was in jail for 8 years and then went back to Geneva. He served his term of 3 years as assistant director. And when his term came up, he made a decision instead of going back to China. That was 1975. 10-year Cultural Revolution is still going. It was towards the end, but he was really worried for his future. He didn't want to get captured again. So he, in his pajama, he went to knock on the door in Geneva, U.S. Embassy. And 24 hours later, he was on a plane flying back to California. My grandmother didn't know, my father didn't know, my mom just married my dad. Nobody knew from the family, so our family was under investigation for 3 years when they were in China. Nobody's allowed to talk about grandpa. So when I was born in the late 70s, and we thought my grandfather, everybody told me my grandfather dead. And later on, Tiananmen Square student revolution happened again, is in our blood. My father vocally, openly supported the student's vision. Well, he was actually held a very high position in technology sector for Chinese government. So he got kicked out of a communist party because after the Tiananmen massacre, and then my grandmother also passed away around the same time. So my dad made a decision in 1989 after Tiananmen Square incidents that he told me, "We're moving to America. By the way, your grandfather is still alive. He's Surprise. Living well in Sonoma. He still practiced medicine for a little bit in Sonoma. And now he's retired, and we're going to meet up with him and then to enjoy, so he can enjoy our family for the rest of his life."
So how does that very typical, normal childhood influence you and who you grew up to be?
So I definitely think because my family is a very different, we're in Beijing, we're in the heart of Beijing, there's so much tradition, food culture, but at the same time, my family is kind of like a Western family. Yeah. They all educated in America, moved back. Growing up, my typical breakfast is not congee or Chinese donuts. Mine is toast, coffee, milk. We eat butter. We had hot dogs growing up. And my grandmother traveled around the world, and then she believed in to educate me, little me, through food about the world culture.
So how would she educate you? She'd be like, this is chocolate, so she know the Swiss, and they're about neutrality.
Yeah, and then she would bring back Coca-Cola and go, this is Coca-Cola from America. In the 1920s, we used to have it in China, but then, you know, after the war, and now we're going to bring this back. And then she will tell me about cheese, where it's made of. So, like, as a little kid, you will, like, I will ask for, can I have stinky feet? And she will be like, stinky feet. Oh, you're talking about cheese. I will also, my favorite food, spaghetti. Mm. I love chocolate and I love ice cream. And then she taught me we watched Sound of Music growing up. And she also taught me how to sing ABC. And then she always asked me to ask her my favorite food in English. So she will bring it back from her traveling. If I don't ask her in English, she wouldn't bring it back to me.
I mean, that's food diplomacy takes on a whole different sort of meaning in your family. But did you feel conflicted? Did you feel that Chinese food was less than or equal to? Or did you not see a comparison between the food that was all around you in Beijing and the sort of the wonders of the world that your grandmother was bringing you?
No, not at all, because she also brings me to national banquets. Mm. So I guess this is sort of like in my spirit, I'm always fearless because I rough shoulder was governor when I was at such a young age and eating abalone. I was never ashamed of when it comes to Chinese banquet, there's last piece of abalone. I'll be like, grandma, let me get that last piece of abalone.
Just reaching in with those chopsticks.
Yeah, just reaching in. I was a little kid. I didn't really care. Like, the manner just fly off the, you know, off my head because I love food. So as a young kid, I was experiencing different textures and then seeing Western wonders, but at the same time see a lot of traditional Chinese dishes and then the imperial banquet style vegetable carving. So I was just so impressed with food world, period, that I wanted to eat, I want to make things on myself. And like for things that I don't get to have in home normally, but if I ate somewhere outside and I will try to come back at age 8, try to recreate them. Even though I have no clue how to recreate them, but I wanted to recreate them.
So you wound up in America in the late 80s, early 90s, and what was it like to move from China and wind up in the States?
So I came to the States in 1993.
Yeah.
It was a big shock, obviously, because even though we studied English, I spoke a little bit, but the culture shock is very different. It's funny because I came from a big city. Yeah. I remember arriving in San Francisco and I look around. There's, you know, the airport, and then we live in the suburb of the Bay Area. So all the houses low profile because of earthquake. So I was asking my dad, I was like, Dad, why you bring me to village? Like, didn't understand the suburbia of America, the concept. And very culture shock. But fortunately, where we moved to, there's a lot of Chinese immigrant and Taiwanese immigrant already. So I made some friends immediately. But in the beginning, it's difficult because I'm very outgoing. Yeah. So not be able to speak the way I want to, communicate the way I want to, was hard, but it only took me a year. It was good.
How did you find the food in America now that you were living here? Did Chinese food take a back seat, or did you still eat the same way where everything was fair game?
Because my parents started their own company, so they were really busy in the Silicon Valley. And then I took on cooking because this is what I always loved. My mom was a doctor when she was in Beijing, so she never was really the cooking person anyways. So I always cooked food for myself growing up because that's what I love. When I came to America, I started doing that, but realized that everything, all the ingredients are very different. Like what I see in China is very different. And so watching food TV, PBS, and just cooking show really help because I want to learn. First of all, I need to learn English. Second of all, I also just want to know what to do with all this new food. I also wander around in the supermarket by myself to read labels and look at what other people buy. I just find food very interesting, but at the same time, I was picking up English and learning English through food.
What was the biggest difference between shopping for food in Beijing versus you now being in San Francisco?
So back then, now Beijing is super modern, just like America. But when I was still in Beijing, you still rely on the smaller, like kind of like a wet market, so open market food. You go into in the morning to buy fresh fish, fresh vegetables, and a lot of more bodega style or smaller store in the neighborhood. Where coming to America, everything is so big. I just remember I was like, why is everything big? Banana, celery, apple, everything, all the fruits are just
shiny.
So big and shiny and beautiful and wax. And then I was like very intrigued. In California, the seasons are so different. You see strawberries side by side with apple. Like that's, you don't see back then in China. China was, Beijing is very seasonal. All four seasons food. We like to, our diet is very seasonal. So I can't kind of wrap my head around when I see summer food next to winter food together. But then later on I realized this is California. This is what we do. We have tomatoes in December.
Yes, we do have tomatoes. And
they're great. Well,
they're great. So your parents work in technology. You sort of have this inkling for cooking. When do you start to think about maybe this is a career? Were your parents into that? How did you start moving into cooking in professional kitchens?
So I went through the whole normal thing. After high school, I did college. And then my dad wanted me to, well, I wanted to do pre-med. I love blood and cutting things. And
there you go.
But I'm horrible at chemistry, so failed twice. And then finally, my dad said, just take business so we can take over the family business. I was like, okay, fine.
Okay.
So I worked in the Silicon Valley for five years. And later on, I met my current husband. We were dating. And then later on, we were seriously dating. I was facing the dot-com bubble bust. And my company was going down. And then my boyfriend or husband was doing really well in his company, his startup. So he said that, why don't you pursue your dreams? Like, why don't you think about what you want to do real? Like, what's your passion
Marry
about?
Marry that man.
And he's like, I'm sick of you complaining about your high-tech job. You know, like, he said, I'm also feel like you're wasting your life away because you do is buying shoes and buy new cars. That was me. I made a lot of money in Silicon Valley. So I was like, okay. I was like, I love to cook, but as a Chinese American, my parents will never let me to think about cooking as a career. So I never thought about cooking as a career.
Right.
It's always a hobby. So he's like, go check out culinary school. So what? It's a hobby, but you should really take some time off and think about what you wanted to do. Do something you love. I was like, okay. So I went to check out.
By the way, that's that American dream right there. Like, oh, you know what? Forget about what your parents want. What do you want to do? What do you love?
Yeah, but you never think about it until I'm actually experienced it. So then I went to CCA, which it doesn't exist anymore, California Culinary Academy. Did a school tour the first half hour, just the smell of the bakery and then hearing people, the chopping sound and checking out the butcher room and seeing them breaking down all those hot, whole animals. I was in love. I was like, I think this is what I want to do. And after that, I just never looked back. I was model students and then wanting to be extern for Thomas Keller and never stopped.
Awesome. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about your professional career. We're going to talk about opening your restaurant. We have a musical song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Oh,
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Chef Shirley Chung in her beautiful and delicious restaurant, Miss Chi, in Culver City. So you've graduated culinary school.
Yep.
How did you get your first externship, and how did you get to work under some of the greats like Thomas Keller and Guy Savoy?
So I went to, my school was located in San Francisco, and I tried to get into, by then the world's best restaurant was French Laundry. So I tried to get into my externship into French Laundry, sent multiple letters, recommendation letter, nobody really cared. So I finally decided I need to go there. So I drove to French Laundry, Yonville, from San Francisco after school every day for 3 weeks or so, just to see if I can go talk to anybody.
Did you do that thing like Buddhist monk where you just like sit outside and just wait?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I see people like walking out and I try to talk to them. No cooks ever talk to you. And the office assistant like kind of showed me the way, gave me an application form that I filled it out, but nobody called me back.
Yeah.
And I finally like had the guts knock on the window, and then my AM sous chef of French Laundry, Mark Hopper, came out, and he became a mentor later on, but he became my first chef. He's like, wow, I saw your face for 3 weeks already. I guess you really want to be here. So that's how I got into the door.
And what was it like working in such a classically French restaurant? What did you learn there?
The first thing is organization. I think it's the most important fundamental young cooks can have, working clean. My first duty was every morning, get into the door is to clean walking and make sure you re-ice all the fish and how to properly put everything away. Everybody always think stocking is nothing. This is not related to cooking. No, it's 100% related to cooking. How you treat your vegetable, your protein, everything properly, how to storage them properly will set the foundation for a great restaurant.
So where was Chinese food sitting inside your brain or in your heart at this time? After going through culinary school and working at the French Laundry, did it have any real appreciation from you? Did you ever consider cooking it, or was it just something that you would make at home?
So yes, Chinese food is always something that I will only make at home, because tell you the truth, I'm a little bit, not embarrassed, but when it comes to Chinese cuisine, I know so much because there's eight different regions. I know it's such an art, but I never really went in there. But also, it's kind of like that thinking that when you think about a traditional Chinese cook, they're like wife beaters, they have a cigarette, they walk, it's very hard work, it's a really rough image, versus when I first came into the culinary world, my first restaurant is French Laundry, and you look at everybody, like their chef coat never get dirty.
Never.
Never. The floor is so clean that we use toothbrush to clean them that you can't eat food off the floor.
And there's so how many cigarettes in the kitchen?
What? There's no smoking break allowed.
Right.
So it's like the prestige of French cuisine, really, for me as a young cook, I was like, this is what I want to do. Like, I want to be the fancy chef. I don't want to be the Chinese chef that kind of like work dirty and just grind it out. That's not what I wanted. So for me, I actually refused to cook Chinese professionally or do anything Chinese for the longest time. And I always joke about it that Chinese cuisine is my weakest cuisine, because I never really learned. It's not until Chino Poblano, which is working for Jose Andres, that's the last time that I worked for somebody. He's the one that put me in that position, even though I kind of tried to say no in the beginning. I didn't want to be the head chef of Chino Poblano. We had a head chef. He wasn't working out. I was only a sous chef. I like the concept, and I feel like this is the first time I kind of do a casual food. I always done fine dining. And I want to learn about this business, because in the future, I feel like this is the price point I want to open a casual restaurant. So that's the reason that I went to work in Chino Poblano.
But ultimately, what was it about working there and seeing what we'll call ethnic food in America elevated to a different level?
I think it's the freedom.
Yeah. A lot of freedom in that.
A lot of freedom. Also, Jose is crazy in a sense, right? So even though I tell him, I was like, my Chinese food is home cooking. My Chinese food is what I know. I'm very deep in the culture. I know the culture so much. But that's why I know there's so much more to learn. Are you sure you want me to run your Chinese kitchen or Chinese Mexican kitchen, where I don't know any of those two cuisines? I just like to eat them.
Yeah.
He's like, but you live and breathe them. You sure. know your culture. And he's like, I wasn't looking for a traditional Chinese food. You can use your creative and your Western type of thinking with Chinese flavor. Why don't you just do whatever you do? So that's what Chino Poblano came about. And I learned from that, I grew a lot of confidence. And I also learned from one of my sous chefs how to cook a professional wok, because he has 17 years of traditional Chinese cuisine in his belt. And other things like folding dim sums and folding dumplings, that's something that I always know what we do at home. So that kind of grew into what I cook Chinese food. But truly, I found my style of cooking was on Top Chef. I know it sounds very cheesy.
Well, let's talk about that, because I feel that being on Top Chef, being on those cooking shows, especially the ones that use professional chefs as contestants, mm-hmm. is what gets people known in America and the world. I think it's really tough just to own a restaurant these days and not play that social media game. But what was it about it? Was it about having to define yourself, to look inward, to sort of say, all right, here's 16 other chefs, what's my unique culinary edge?
So I became Top Chef twice. So the first time I said I found my culinary voice is because before I just cook anything. People was like, I said, I cook cuisine with no borders. I can cook anything, Italian, French, Spanish, Mexican, Chinese, you throw at me, I cook everything.
Which is sort of cooking nothing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I also realized that when it comes to competition, when you don't have anything to, you don't have time to think. You just react on your, is your reaction. Oh, I cook is, this is close to my heart. I use a lot of big Chinese flavors, and then sometimes I use Chinese technique, but a lot of times I use a Western technique to sort of deliver the result that was supposed to be. And on the second time around on Top Chef, I realized my niche is cooking Chinese American food. This is what I want to be for my next step of my career, that I really want to push my culture. And I realized I'm finally comfortable in my skin that I can come out to say that I'm very proud of who I am. I would like to cook Chinese food that's true to myself and I'm proud of. So that's...
When you finally stumbled or came to that moment of being proud and prideful of the food that you make, what was that? Was there more freedom there and like what you felt that you could do because you were so excited to share these flavors with your customers?
Yes, 100%. Now I really feel like I'm at the place that I feel a lot more comfortable. Before, I always, when people criticize my food saying that, oh, this is not authentic, I always like to be defensive of it. I was like, no, but Northern China of Dalian, they've been using black squid ink to color their dough. So they will make squid ink and fish dumpling for ages. So I'm not doing this because I cook Italian, but I'm actually doing this for Chinese. I used to constantly defend myself, yes. But now I'm like, you know what? This is the way I cook Chinese food.
Yeah.
This is Chinese food in California. This is Chinese food in America. I'm 100% submerged in this culture. I'm not cooking any region of Chinese food from China. I'm cooking Chinese food for America.
Now, when people think of Chinese American food, they definitely think of styrofoam boxes.
Orange chicken,
General Tso, just, you know, also like fried and then even
greasy
chicken wings even pop in there sometime. How do you define your Chinese American food? And do you ever run into where people come and eat your food and they go, no, I know Chinese American food. I've been growing up and eating that. This is not Chinese American food.
Well, I haven't had people tell me this is not Chinese American food yet, but I definitely have people tell me that, oh, wow, I'm surprised this is Chinese American food. Normally, I'm not really, this is like a lot of Chinese Americans telling me this,
yeah.
That they're not really into those kind of restaurants, but they love my restaurant. They've been coming more than multiple times in a week. My approach is Chinese food, seasonal, fresh ingredient, mm-hmm. just like when I cook Italian, just when I cook French, but with Chinese authentic ingredient sauces from China, using local California American produce and proteins and everything else. So naturally, and at the same time that my kitchen in Miss Chi, we don't have a wok. We cook everything on flat tops on a plancha. So you can still create that char with grilling, with cooking on plancha. It's all about heat control.
Right.
You don't have to have a wok.
Right.
A lot of times when you eliminate wok, you eliminate a lot of oil.
Yes.
Because wok just sits. We do oil blanching, you do deep fry, you do everything in a wok. So that's a little bit different approach from my kitchen. So naturally, our cooking is just a lot less greasy because the way we cook.
So let's talk about Ms. Chi. When did the idea start coming around to open up a restaurant? And it seems pretty much like the culmination of an entire life's experience from, you know, your grandparents to your coming to America to the fine dining, but then also being like, you know what, I really just want to have something that's a little bit casual, but you still have a really great meal.
Yeah, so Ms. Chi's crazy concept, we open breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Everybody, and then we sell boba tea.
By the way,
and
not
coffee
a lot,
program.
And not a lot of Chinese restaurants open for breakfast.
No, not at all. But this is what I want to do. Like, I open Ms. Chi is a lifetime of what I want to eat.
Right.
So in Ms. Chi, I have boba tea, I have coffee, I love caffeinated beverages, which chef doesn't? So
I'm a real decaf type of chef.
What? and then I love breakfast, Chinese, Western, all those sort of things. Mm. Just, I love eggs. And so everything together, Ms. Chi is something that is ultimate Chinese comfort food. A slightly elevated level is everything that I want to eat. That's why I said that when I'm at home, I want to DoorDash or Postmate my own food, because this is the food that I will actually crave at home.
So now the food that you only cooked at home that you would never share with anyone, that's what's in the restaurant.
Yes, it's 100% that. A cook at home is everything is very comfort, but we don't cheap out on the ingredient. We have farmers market in front of our door every Tuesday, yes. So we get to pick up fresh produce from in front of our doorstep. And working with a lot of different farmers on proteins, and then I work with a hippie farmer in Oregon, do our Pachamama pork for Beijing Zhajiang Mian's pork ragu. It's like we're so blessed. And then making all the dumplings that I used to make since when I was 6 years old. Like Beijing style of dumpling, but at the same time get to putting the crazy cheeseburger dumpling that I won a challenge of from Top Chef onto the menu too. So, and I have salt and pepper tater tots because I love salt and pepper pork chop and shrimp. So, but I didn't want it to do, you know, this is our sort of neighborhood. I want to do something gluten free, so I do salt and pepper tater tots, and you know, silly little things like that is everything that I want to eat.
It's very interesting because it is American in the sense of that there's no rules, manifest destiny, follow your dream, what makes you happy. But the Chinese part is coming in like, here's the heritage, here are the ingredients, here are the recipes that you grew up with and that you learned from your grandmother, mother, and things like that.
Yeah.
You have a cookbook now too.
Yes.
What made you want to distill the recipes and put it into a cookbook? What did you think was lacking as far as Chinese food recipes and cookbooks for the chef at home?
I think just in general, when people think about Chinese cuisine, the non-Chinese people think about Chinese cuisine, even the Chinese American that grew up in China, that grew up in America, they think it's extremely intimidating because the first thing, like, you have to buy a wok, buy a bamboo steamer, buy this and the other. So people already stop wanting to cook because you have to buy all these things that you to cook one cuisine
or
one
dish. I bought a wok once. And I ruined it immediately and never used it again.
Exactly, right? So a lot of times people just stop thinking about or wanting to learn about this cuisine because all those restrictions. So I want to be the ambassador of Chinese cuisine in America to teach people how to cook Chinese food without all those limits. You can, so just by teaching people how to heat control, but most importantly, just source your ingredient using the correct sauce to produce authentic flavors. And I really feel like a lot of cuisine, ethnic cuisine, having moments. There's Filipino cuisine. A few years ago there were Thai cuisine.
Yeah.
And then Chinese cuisine, Japanese cuisine has always been very popular, became the most popular Asian cuisine in America now. But the most popular ethnic cuisine that people don't even realize is still Chinese cuisine.
Of course.
People don't think about it.
Well, it's ubiquitous.
Exactly.
It's because it's like pizza.
Yeah, it's not.
People don't think about that. It's like when people are, you know, like, you know, they're like, oh, I don't like Mexicans, but I love burritos. It's like, what are you talking about?
Exactly.
So it's become American in many ways, but it's just like, no, it has deeper roots. It has its own place in the world cultural zeitgeist. Imagine if someone's grandmother in America came back and brought them like wontons and Chinese donuts and things like that.
Yeah. And also you think about a lot of Asian cuisines is all influenced by Chinese cuisine as well. Talk about Mapo Tofu, right?
Talk about ramen.
Yeah. So all this, you think about, oh, ramen is Japanese. No, ramen in Chinese name is actually translated from Chinese word 拉面, which just means pool noodle. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like a lot of that people really don't know. So I really hope that that's why I come out with cookbook that's easy for everybody to use. I didn't come out with a coffee table cookbook. That's for my ego. But because I really want to push, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I really want to push this cuisine forward in America. This is a popular cuisine in America already, but now I just want people to truly love it, to know it a little bit more, to understand it a little bit more.
So what's next? You got the cookbook, you got the cafe. What's coming up this year?
Definitely expansion. Ms. Shi, I have a lot of different opportunities, people approaching me, which is, I feel very thankful. Mm-hmm. We've only been opening for 3 months, but there's multiple people already want me to open everywhere. So my next step is slow down a little bit to really look through all the offer.
Yeah.
I want to grow this brand, but at the same time, I want to push forward Chinese American cuisine in America.
Well, we are very lucky to have you doing just that.
Thank you.
If people want to follow you, if people want more information, where can they go?
So they can go on chefshirleychung.com. That's my personal website. Or you can also follow me on social media. It spells CHF Shirley Chung.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Can
thank
I wait to dip
me.
Into some dumplings? Of course.
Yes,
oh
please.
My God. Yes. I mean, to me, I can eat dumplings at any time. I love dumplings for breakfast, so it's perfect. We have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kotbock cave-aged cheeses, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Dave Arnold, and I'm the host of Cooking Issues here on Heritage Radio Network. Every week, I answer listeners' questions on the latest innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients in the food world. Have a question about hot rotting your oven to make great pizza? Give us a call. Hydrocolloid, sous vide, liquid nitrogen? No problem. You can find Cooking Issues wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
It's so good. That is 100% Greg's mind's total sweet spot for music. Annie, welcome back to the Snacky Tunes.
Hi.
It's so good to see you.
It's so nice to see you.
And it's so funny because when Radical Dads, who are so awesome, who are also about to drop a kid.
Two kids.
So many play dates.
Yeah.
Yeah. What? No?
They're moving.
Oh, they're moving?
Robbie's moving to California, and then Chris and Lindsay are moving to New Jersey, so I'm just going to cry.
Oh, man.
I'm just going to stay home and cry.
And Heather's in San Francisco?
What do I have left in my life?
I don't know, just like a handsome husband and two beautiful children and your music.
Oh, yeah. And cooking.
So I guess nothing. Welcome back. It's so good to see you. I always love seeing you. But it was funny because I guess you were sitting down when I saw you and I didn't realize that you're like 2 weeks from dropping this kid.
Yeah.
And then when I saw you, I was like, she is very pregnant.
Yeah.
But like in the most beautiful way possible.
Oh, thank you.
So welcome.
Thanks.
So happy.
Ditto.
Solo project. Which was a surprise. It was just on my, I think, I want to say either Facebook feed or Instagram feed or something that I was like, oh, she's doing a song. And I was like, it's a good song.
Oh, thank you.
Can't Stop, Won't Stop.
It's like Heather's gone. You can't have a trio and downgrade to a duo without betraying the essence of the trio. So you kind of just have to go it alone.
You could start a new group called Heather Moved Away.
Heather Moved Away. And I hate it.
First song is Whatever. So what made you want to do the solo project?
Well, it's kind of like I started playing music because I just have always been hypnotized by music. I've always been obsessed with just playing by myself, and I never thought anybody in the whole world would ever want to hear it. And then I've been encouraged over the years to either join bands or was literally forced to join my first band. And then, you know, I came to this place where, why am I going to be alone playing synthesizers? There's more to honor the synthesizers that I've been spending so much money on than anything else. I feel like if you have these ideas, you should share them.
Yeah. It's like honoring your sushi knife.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so I told you about my sushi knife. I went to Kyoto. We were on tour. Au revoir, Simone was on tour.
I did not know that.
Okay,
go on.
And we're in Japan. And I found, so there's this, oh, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's Aritsugu or something. There's like a very famous sushi knife place in Kyoto. But then apparently that's just like the tourist trap one.
Okay.
But there's this dude who's like 90 years old. Mm-hmm. And I had to take a taxi really far out of town. He is right across from this temple. So I guess a lot of people go there. But he doesn't speak English. And you have to like, he makes these knives. He forges these knives in his backyard and sells them to anybody who wants a knife.
And you got one?
I got one. And it was great because I'm mostly vegetarian, so I mostly cut up vegetables, and we were drawing pictures and miming. He taught me how to sharpen the knife. You know, I don't know. It was great. And ever since then, I've been obsessed with this knife. It's so sharp.
So sharp. Those cucumbers, so thin.
So thin.
So thin. Do you want to play a song for us?
Yeah.
What do you want to play for us first?
I guess I'll play Breathing Underwater, even though you already played it at the intro.
Yeah, but that was a recorded one. Put a little live.
This is different keyboards.
Okay. Are you all set up with your microphone and everything?
I
Do I have to do anything? Let me see.
Let me just check.
Oh, you're good. Thank you.
Thanks.
You can talk on that microphone.
Yeah. You like my?
Oh, Liz is saying no. Oh, Taskmaster Liz.
All right, I'm back.
Oh my goodness.
I can
goodness.
Handle this.
Yeah. Whipped it.
So, how is the writing process now? It's just you without the trio? I mean, are you like I'm gonna put this sound here?
Well, I gotta say it's really hard because I've been so reliant on Heather and Erica to kind of you were so sweet.
We're just playing musical chairs. There we go.
Kind of literally.
oh.
So
like that.
it's funny because when I work with Heather and Erica, I have them to rely on about like what sounds good and what doesn't sound good, and we're all so brutally honest with each other that it makes it really easy to trust them and to trust yourself. But it's kind of like, oh, this sounds great. Oh, that sounds great. But I did notice that most of my songs have become incredibly simple.
Really? Oh, because you're just focusing on just getting it out?
Or just like, this song sounds good.
Right, and then you're done. You move on. You don't have that feedback that people be like, actually, it sounds good, but maybe.
Yeah, plus there's not six hands. There's only like, I have two hands. And yes, I'll have like 10 tracks of keyboards, but, you know, it's easy.
It's easy. This track sounds done. Let's go.
But next. learning to record is really difficult.
Oh, when you're by yourself.
Yeah, and also dinner time is a problem because I have my studio in my basement.
Yeah,
and the kitchen is right upstairs, and so you're just like, oh, I don't really feel like comping. You'd be really great using my new Japanese chef knife.
Oh yeah, man. That, I mean, it's the same creative process, right?
No.
No.
Not at all.
What, cooking and making music? Totally different things.
Well, I mean, I guess they both require creativity and ingredients. Okay, I'm starting to see the analogy.
I don't really see it. I think it was bad, and he's trying to save it.
Oh, man.
Let's leave the cooking to the chefs.
Man, we have been trying to just draw this analogy between food and music for like 7 or 8 years.
Okay, so you got your ingredients.
Okay.
And if you don't have quality ingredients, it's not going to work out.
Right, and if you don't have quality synthesizers, you're not going to make a hot track.
Yeah, exactly. But some of the best music I've ever heard has been made on like really bad equipment.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, but what constitutes bad?
I mean, just like, you know, like instruments that people bought at like Walmart or got as gifts, but yet they just did a really great job.
Yeah,
I'm really just trying to lay into Darren's
idea. He's got it. It's cool.
You're not buying it.
I'm not totally buying it. I've had a lot of like amazing meals cooked on like things that I wouldn't want to eat.
George Foreman grills.
I've had a few. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Thomas Keller uses them at Per Se, right?
Wouldn't know.
Really?
Wouldn't know.
I'm just kidding.
But,
I'm just kidding.
But Timmy down the hall in college really used it, and he was great.
Timmy Keller. Never mind. So the writing process is a little different. Do you enjoy the solo process and just like figuring, like seeing where your brain takes you with not being edited?
I mean, it's cool because I think the schedule really suits my life. It's like, okay, I have 45 minutes at night now that I have a kid to like get stuff done. So it makes rehearsing and writing a lot more free because I feel like I have this, I can just do it without having to run it by anybody. So I can do it on my own time. Whereas before we'd have to schedule something where we'd all be around, and we mostly did our writing collaboratively. So, you know, that takes a while. This is just more simple, but I do miss them.
Oh, they're amazing women.
I know.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It's okay, but
I'm getting used to it.
Yeah. Maybe you can like start like a family band, like the Trachtenbergs.
Do you feel like that's child? I mean, no, I don't know about the Trachtenbergs. I don't know them personally, but do you feel like that whole concept is kind of like child exploitation? Like, I try not to have Henry on any of my public persona things.
I heard Henry actually didn't want to be on your tracks. That's what I read in the trade. But
I feel like it might be like taking advantage.
You don't want to do like a Blue Ivy track with Henry? With the new one?
No. Not really. But you know what Henry is really good for? He is just as brutally honest as Heather and Erica.
Really?
Yeah, like Breathing Underwater he loved. He wanted to hear it all the time. I looked at my iTunes. I had the demo played like 87 times in the car.
Number one with a bullet, right?
No.
But were there other tracks where he's like, Mom, no.
Yeah, he'll. If I play one that's like kind of a downer, he's like, that's too boring.
Ooh, way harsh.
I know, it's
I
great
mean, kids
though.
Are, they're honest yeah. though. It's kind of like nice to hear it. It's refreshing.
Yeah, I'm really into it.
All right, can we hear a track that he likes?
Yeah.
Okay, what is it?
This one doesn't have a name yet.
Can we call it Henry's song?
It's about my this guy I was sleeping with in high school.
Let's definitely not call it Henry's song. Okay. Well, this one goes to. Do you want to say his name?
No.
No.
Well, he was cheating on his girlfriend.
You were
and
in high school.
He was like, if you sleep with me, I'm gonna totally break up with her and go out with you. And then I did. And then he didn't. But we still kept on sleeping together.
Still friends.
No.
Godfather. Henry's godfather. No. Here we go. Annie Hart again live here on Snacky Tunes. We'll be right back. Awesome. Very nice.
Well, thanks.
Oh, yeah. So, what's the plan? EP? LP? Double
length? I don't know. What are you supposed to do?
I put out two EPs in my entire life, and they both, no one ever listened to them, so.
Yeah, so are you supposed to, like, hire a publicist and print it and everything?
You're the one with a successful music career.
That's true. Okay, I guess I do know what
you
do.
What you did. You got flown all over the world to play your music.
Yeah.
So you know.
And paid. And not paid. Just the flight. And free food.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God, guys, you have
what
to go on
doing?
Tour.
Oh,
you yeah, went on geez. Tour. We saw you on tour.
Yeah,
saw you. Several times.
Yeah, and then you can also make salads in the bathroom in the dark.
Oh, yeah, you remember that story.
That story's so good. You can listen. That's from the last episode with Salad for President.
Oh, yeah.
That was...
I still do that. And, you know, I started taking photos of my hotel salads. It's on my Instagram. Annie Hart for sure. You can see some of my hotel
Annie
salads.
Annie for sure. It's a good gram. The gram game's good.
I was pretty wasted when I came up with it, so thanks.
Whatever works.
Yeah. It's whatever's clever, as I say. I don't know. You put an EP out. I mean, you're about to have another kid, so touring is going to be...
Yeah, I haven't played any concerts yet by myself, and I think it's kind of I want to have like kind of an art element to it because I'm so used to having Heather and Erica with me where I'm like, nobody's watching me, so I can just be happy and be relaxed.
Oh, come on, no one's watching you.
But you can like get into that mindset.
Karen's watching.
I'm watching you. Like not in that way. I'm like, oh, I'm so proud of her. She's doing so well.
Oh, I was thinking, I missed my cue for the song. There's a police song about that.
Oh.
But anyway.
Yeah. There's a lot of songs about watching people. Like Private Eyes. Yeah. Hung out with my mom that morning just listening to like Hall & Oates. It was pretty nice.
Okay, so I have this thing with Hall & Oates where until I was maybe 21, I thought their name was Hauling Oates.
Oh my God.
Right, and then I bought my first Hall and Oates thing, and I was like, "Oh, it's Hall and Oates." And then you know, I just discovered my friend sent me this link. She remembers the story because she thought I was so stupid. And then she sends me this thing. There's a Hall and Oates granola company that's getting sued as of last month by Hall and Oates.
That's so good.
Somebody else had that idea. It's not just me.
There's a thing called Call and Oates, which is a call number where you can call and they like press one, Private Eyes, press two, like Rich Girl, yeah.
That's just, like the They Might Be Giants style of song.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Stuff when, yeah, it's like, oh, they got a touchdown phone. What can we do?
Yeah. I wish I had a...
Now if only I had songs on demand. I wish that technology still existed.
What did you listen to? Wait a second. What?
I'm making jokes.
I was like, what?
The jokes are so bad.
You're on fire today.
Yeah, on fire.
But maybe that's what I should do with the music.
Yeah, that'd be a fun art project.
Yeah.
Call this number to listen to the track.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I could just put up demos.
Yeah.
And then it's not as permanent as like SoundCloud or whatever, I don't know, Spotify.
It's true.
Or you can just have Henry like them up to the top.
Wow.
Yeah. So you're going to keep recording demos.
Yeah.
You're going to put out the second child.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Thanks.
And then maybe tour, EP, something like that.
Yeah, I think I'm going to play some shows in New York. I mean, I have a bunch of friends who own really cool venues, so I'm going to have my friend kind of do some kind of overhead art projection while I play, and I'm going to bring all my best synthesizers, which I've been told by synthesizer lovers that I'm forbidden from bringing out of the house.
Oh, really?
Yeah, these synths I'm playing today are great synths, and talk about garbage. One of them is kind of a...
Sound great.
Student start / child model.
My very first synth.
But I got some other really fancy synths that I think deserve to be showcased.
And you're not supposed to take them out of the house?
No, I mean, they're so delicate. They're the kind of thing that are made for studios. Like, I bet Genesis wouldn't even tour with them.
Uh-oh.
Are those fighting words?
I don't know. Phil Collins, I mean, Phil. Look, Phil's going to do what Phil's going to do. You know what I mean?
Usually these have synths at home.
Yeah. All right, well, where can people go to SoundCloud?
Oh, yeah, it's SoundCloud/Annie-Hart. There's other Annie Harts out there that are not me.
Imitations not to be trusted.
Yeah.
How do we know it's you?
How do you know it's me? There's a picture of me with sunglasses.
Okay.
Cool mom. Super cool mom.
Super cool mom.
Man, that wedding happening in the backyard.
Yeah, there's a crazy, awesome wedding going on.
No, that was my applause button for super cool mom.
Oh, yeah.
Well, no, they're with you. They like totally agree. It's all family all the time.
They did a acapella version of "Don't Stop Believing." which, yeah.
All right, let's wrap.
They also sing, didn't they also sing Gloria in Excelsis Deo? When I walked in, they were singing like Christmas carols.
Maybe
they were doing all the Jewish wedding songs.
Hey man,
out there,
it's your wedding is whatever you want to do.
Yeah,
yeah.
It'll be yours next March 27th.
Oh, I'm gonna just plan it around.
Do I get to go to your wedding,
dude? Ooh. You're gonna come to the bachelor party.
That's true. I was speaking to somebody. I have a friend who the other day he got to go to a bachelor party, but he wasn't invited to that guy's wedding.
That doesn't make any sense.
It made no sense.
He must have really fucked up during the bachelor party.
Yeah.
I don't think it was ever part of the plan. I just thought that was really strange.
Essentially, what I've learned that if you invite anyone to the pre-wedding events,
you have to invite them
party,
to the big
party,
deal.
They got to come to the
main
big,
event.
Yeah, to the main event.
Yes.
Ah, I want to know what that was.
I'll tell you a little bit more about it offline.
Oh, okay. Wow. No, you'll be coming. And there's an engagement party. We're going to go to Montreal. It'll be fun.
I can't imagine what going to Montreal with you might be like.
Yes, you can, because we did it, and it was deliciously decadent, if you will.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Poutine forever.
I know, it was the craziest blizzard I've ever experienced.
We drove into Montreal the day after the largest single snowfall
ever. And for Montreal, that's a lot.
Wait, so it happened the day after?
No, drove in the day before.
Oh, the day before.
And we were driving around, and we eventually just had to shovel out a parking spot. We were like driving. We got in like 1 at night, and we went and got like
So much shoveling snow
hot,
that weekend.
Dozen hot Saint Victor bagels.
And then
we were living. The place we had was equidistant from Fairmont Saint Victor.
Oh my god! I used to live like right around in that area.
Very lucky.
Very lucky.
Yeah, I know. And we would just every day try out each different bagel and decide which one is our favorite,
today I'll have a sesame, and then tomorrow I'll have a sesame, and then the day after that I'll have a sesame.
And they're so small, it's like you can just eat as many as you want.
Oh yeah.
They don't even count as bagels.
No. Not like these behemoth New York ones.
No.
We don't have enough time to talk about New York bagels.
We can do a whole Montreal edition of this show one day.
Yeah.
You know what I'm looking for in New York? Hot pretzels. When are we going to start the gourmet hot pretzel brigade?
I don't know. I think people still are bummed on carbs. Right?
No.
No? I don't know.
I think there's a carb backlash.
I don't know. Hot pretzel and mustard bar would be phenomenal.
It's true.
Doing sandwiches. They used to ever go to Philly and they have like sort of like a figure eight pretzels and you cut those in half and you make that's your bread for a sandwich?
No.
Did I just explode your mind?
You know, everybody's always like, oh, Philly's the next Williamsburg. And now I'm
not true.
Kind of,
not true.
Right. Well, obviously it's
Thank
not true,
God.
But now, but don't you, aren't you like intrigued a little by Philly?
I grew up in Philly.
I love Philly.
Oh, you
I love
grew up
Philly.
In Philly.
I love it.
Philly's wonderful.
It's no sixth borough.
Well, we know the New York Times keeps telling me every day that the sixth borough is Los Angeles.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
There was another article today about New Yorkers packing up and going to Los
that.
Angeles.
But
who
you know
does
what?
That? Who packs up and moves
All
to LA?
All my friends, because
I don't know.
Like...
Maybe you, jerk. Whatever. Have fun. Take your beard out there.
Your beard out there. Go say hi to everybody. I'm always like, I haven't seen you in a couple months. Let's hang out. Oh, I'm in LA.
If
constant.
You have full permission to punch me in the face of Travis and I buy matching fedoras.
I'm not going to punch you in the face. Whatever. You know, just have fun.
Just have fun. Have fun in that fedora. Maybe I'll get a bucket hat. I don't know. So many options.
You're definitely getting cargo pants.
We're a KFC bucket.
Yeah, definitely getting some
cargo
shorts.
Pants and some Tevas.
Oh, yeah. Guess what? My toes are going to get so tan out there.
Such a jerk.
All right. Well, we have time for one more song.
Oh, really?
Do you not want to play one more song?
I mean, I could.
Well, you're not
It's buying. Kind of a downer song.
That's fine.
Is that okay?
Yeah. We'll just tell Henry not to listen. I want to thank you. Thank you to Brutal Mag, Joe and Nick, Feeding the Fire. And on May 12th, we return for our 8th season of the Barbecue Blowout. We have the wonderful boys of Greenpoint Fish and Lobster Co.
Shout out Adam and Vinny.
Shout out to those two guys doing grilled fish tacos with Gustavo Salsa. And Gustavo's going to be on Snacky Tunes next week. And we have the wonderful men of Turing Machine, Justin and Scott, throwing to the decks down.
It's the kickoff to summer.
It's a kickoff to summer. May 12th. Ticket sales are actually really awesome. So
they should be.
You can go to
heritageradionetwork.org
and look for the Barbecue Blowout poster. Or if you go to BBQ Blowout May 12th. 2015. Eventbrite.com.
Nobody's going to remember that.
Just go to heritagenetwork.org and you can see the poster. Liz's thumbs up to that. Shaking her head at the other stuff.
She's really just like the master today.
She was like, wait, if I just speak to them with a voice of authority, they're going to do whatever I say. We're like, yes, Liz. I'm sorry, Liz. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. What? Oh, my God. Psyching me out. Well, Annie, thank you so much. Carter, thank you as always.
Pleasure.
Shout out to the fam. Shout out to Anna. We'll see you next week, and enjoy the summer. Here we go.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.